Hello there. Today is Friday, August 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with the support of President Trump, Israel bans two Democratic U.S. congresswomen critical of the Jewish state.
This is a direct insult to the people of the U.S., to the representatives of the American people, to the whole American political system.
The Ebola's epidemic's impact on children left without parents. Also ahead, it's the 50th anniversary of one of the most iconic musical festivals in American history. It's all on today's International Edition. Israel barred two U.S. lawmakers from entering the country Thursday, setting off a new round of controversy in the debate over U.S. support for its ally in the Middle East. Democratic Congresswomen Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib have been vocal critics of Israel and its treatment of the Palestinians. They were set to visit Israel and several cities in the West Bank in the coming days. Reporter Linda Gradstein in Israel says it was quite a surprise.
Originally, Israeli officials said they would let them in out of respect for the fact that they are congresswomen and would let them enter. However, Israel today changed its mind. I think Israel said they had concerns that if they went through with that plan, that there would be violence.
President Trump has been on the attack of the congresswomen in recent days and again in a tweet expressed support of Israel's decision.
So the things that they've said, Omar, Tlaib, what they've said is disgraceful. So I can't imagine why Israel would let them in. But if they want to let them in, they can. But I can't imagine why they would do it.
Palestinian Executive Committee member Hanan Ashrawi says the Israelis are trying to blockade the Palestinians in a whole new way.
They don't want the Palestinians to interact with anybody in the outside world. And at the same time, they are violating the rights of the American people to find out, to know the truth through their own representatives.
Well, joining us to talk more about this is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us, sir. What is your reaction to these developments?
I was really surprised. It is something that just isn't done. And second, terrible mistake. It isn't done because, you know, the U.S. is a democratic country. It's got duly elected representatives. And the idea of one of our allies keeping out some of our duly elected representatives is really quite shocking. And as I said, I think it's also a mistake for Mr. Netanyahu to do this.
The White House at first said, no, Trump had nothing to do with this, but he did tweet it out that it would show great weakness if Israel allowed Representative Omar and Tlaib to visit. He said they hate Israel, they hate all Jewish people.
But of course, that's nonsense, and he knows it's nonsense. As with so many things with Mr. Trump, one has to ask himself, setting aside what he tweets, why is he doing this? And it strikes me that it's possible, I don't know this, of course, but it's possible that Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Trump are using each other. I mean, it's interesting, they have some real similarities. They've both sort of come under legal fire. They've both inspired strong feelings in their respective countries. And I think that each can be viewed as helping the other. And I think that's what's going on here. As I said earlier, I think it's really risky for Israel.
Do you think that this would have happened without the encouragement of President Trump?
That's a good question. No, I think not. But I think in any event, if Mr. Trump had said, wait a minute, these are duly elected representatives, they shall be let in, They would have been let in.
He's defending Israel's decision.
Yes, he encouraged it. He didn't just defend it, he encouraged it.
Does this set a precedent?
It's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, yes, of course, by definition, it sets a precedent. But I'm not sure how many presidents are going to, when they defend whatever they do, are going to invoke Donald Trump's name.
They've spoken out against a lot of Israel's policies,
yep.
But there are plenty of other people that are actually Jewish. These women are Muslim, but that are Jewish that have maybe criticized policies. Does that mean that they hate Jews in Israel?
No, of course it doesn't mean that. And as I say, I think it's risky. If Mr. Trump loses the election, Israel could end up paying a price for this in lots of different ways. Remember, Israel is dependent on the United States in many respects. And I don't mean just, you know, we send them money, but they get enormous military support from us. They get a lot of financial help. They also get a lot of intelligence support from the U.S. And I could easily see a president, or for that matter, a Speaker of the House saying, I think we'll trim this a little bit.
All right. That is Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Well, the Trump administration recently announced it's moving forward with one of its most aggressive steps yet to restrict legal immigration, denying green cards to many migrants who use Medicaid, food stamps, housing vouchers, or other forms of public assistance. It's part of a dramatic overhaul of the nation's immigration system that the administration's been working to put in place, despite legal pushback. Joining us to talk more about this is Justin Guest, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University and author of the book, The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in the Age of Immigration and Inequality. Justin, this whole idea of public assistance seems to be driving part of this decision.
Public charge rules are concerned about weeding out immigrants who are principally receiving their income from sources of government welfare, who basically are dependent on the state in order to survive. And the idea behind these rules, which are in existence in other countries as well and have been in the United States for some time now, are to remove or make it more difficult for immigrants to stay in the country if they are not able to actually support themselves. However, what this rule does is it really tightens screws on immigrants, and it actually is more restrictionist than before, because rather than being concerned about whether someone is principally on welfare and dependent on welfare for long periods of time, which is the way the law has been enforced before, now the law will be enforced in such a way where if an immigrant has ever in their lives been dependent on welfare, has ever received public assistance, which is obviously something that many people have done over the course of their lives, depending on hardship or just bad luck.
I would imagine that people that are immigrating to this country, they're coming here for a better life. So it would seem to be sort of contradictory if people had a lot of money where they were and things were great, they wouldn't want to come here.
Well, refugees will be exempted from this rule. But you're right. Many other immigrants who are not refugees, they are experiencing hardship often when they come, or they begin as low-income immigrants before they work themselves up the ladder in their attempts to achieve the American dream. And what welfare support is there for is to basically help them in their acute times of need, get them onto their feet, allowing them to survive and then push forward into a career and contribution to the economy. The spirit of this rule goes against that idea because it basically penalizes people who have ever needed welfare assistance.
Is this something that the administration can enact on its own, or does it need to go through Congress?
So for now, the administration seems to think that they can do this without an act of Congress. However, there are arguments that they're overextending their authority and that they may actually be doing things that disproportionately affect certain racial minorities, which could lead to the rule being struck down judicially. That remains to be seen. What the administration's strategy has been, though, has been to identify as many things upon immigration that they can do without congressional support, without congressional legislation, because they know how hard it is to actually get immigration laws passed by a divided Congress.
Looks like immigrants from Europe and Canada will be the least likely to have issues and problems under these new regulations. But by contrast, recent arrivals from Mexico and the Caribbean who have pretty modest incomes would probably be at the highest risk for suffering from this. Is that accurate?
I cannot speculate on what the administration is trying to achieve here in terms of whether they're trying to target certain races or ethnicities. That is one of the effects of this law, though, because the people who will be most acutely affected by it will be people who are not high-skilled immigrants and people who are more vulnerable or near the poverty line at some point during their lives. And immigrants from Canada and Europe are disproportionately high-skilled and therefore less likely to require welfare during the course of their time in the United States. However, that doesn't mean that they may not fall onto hard times as well, and that's exactly what welfare is for. It's to basically be a safety net, a backup for people.
Would you say that immigrants are costing U.S. taxpayers, or are they contributing to the U.S. economy?
By far, immigrants contribute everything from enormous amounts of tax dollars, enormous amounts of small business ownership and creation, the filing of U.S. patents and innovation, and huge skill shortages as well. Their contributions to the American economy and to many economies around the world really cannot be quantified. It is that important and that large.
My understanding is that undocumented immigrants in the United States also sort of inadvertently contribute to the U.S. economy, because when they get a paycheck, they're normally putting a fake Social Security number, and therefore there is money coming out of their checks and going into the Social Security Administration coffers, but they'll never see it because it's not a real Social Security number and they won't ever be collecting it. So therefore, in a way, the U.S. government is collecting millions of dollars in Social Security money that they don't have to distribute.
immigrants broadly, undocumented and documented, contribute tax dollars into the Social Security Administration. Immigrants are also disproportionately younger and of working age, which means that they help our demographic balance by paying into welfare and pension systems rather than needing to take out of them. And as you say, many are not actually ever going to be eligible to take out of them.
Do you think that the Trump administration's ongoing hardline immigration policies will alter the face of American immigration?
If by alter the face of American immigration, you're referring to like the racial and ethnic complexion of American immigration. All of the techniques and acts of the Trump administration thus far have been made with executive orders and are therefore reversible by future administrations or revisable by future administrations. So they all could be temporary in nature if they're not extended and made permanent. If we're talking about what the future complexion of the United States looks like, it is unlikely to really alter that in any kind of meaningful long-term way, simply because of the nature of American fertility rate. Racial minorities in the United States have higher fertility rates than the native-born white population. Native-born immigrant origin minorities also have slightly higher fertility rates as well. And that is something that no U.S. policies are ever really going to be able to change.
All right, that's Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. He's also the author of the book, The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A U.S. envoy slams the Afghan government's anti-corruption resolve. An Iranian oil tanker has been freed by Gibraltar despite U.S. appeal. An appeals court says the U.S. must provide soap and toothpaste to detained children. And Somalia assesses al-Shabaab moles infiltration in the government. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the UN Children's Fund reports the number of children orphaned or separated from parents infected with the disease, with Ebola disease, has more than doubled since April. The agency says Ebola orphaned children are stigmatized by the disease and suffer discrimination. Lisa Schlein reports for us from Geneva.
Since the epidemic was declared more than 1 year ago, aid agencies have registered 1,380 children who have lost one or both parents to Ebola. During the same period, nearly 2,470 children have been separated from parents undergoing treatment for the disease or isolated because they have come in contact with an infected person. World Health Organization figures put the number of Ebola cases at 2,831, including nearly 1,900 deaths. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says more children are getting sick and dying in this epidemic than in previous ones.
In this epidemic, about 30% of the cases are among children, whereas in previous epidemics, the proportion was about 20%. As of the 4th of August, there were 787 children below 18 who were infected with Ebola, and there had been 527 deaths.
Mercado says the children are under enormous stress and need extensive physical, psychosocial, and social care. Given the more than doubling of children in need, she says these specialized services must be urgently scaled up, especially in Beni, where the largest number of children are affected.
For children with no surviving parents, the needs are longer term. The teams work to place children with relatives or foster families, which is not easy given the economic burden of raising extra children and the fear of catching the disease or being associated with it. It often requires delicate mediation as well as financial support for food, school fees, and other basic necessities.
The UNICEF spokeswoman tells VOA the work being done by psychosocial assistance is critical because stigma against Ebola orphans is pervasive. She says children who have been in contact with someone infected with the virus often are rejected by families and communities who believe they will become sick. This, she says, is when social workers step in to convince these people they have nothing to fear and that providing loving care for their children will help them thrive. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Scary folk tales and urban legends have always captivated people's imagination, especially the young. Now, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, a collection of short horror stories for children by author Alvin Schwartz and illustrator Stefan Gammel, has been adapted for the large screen by an Oscar-winning producer and director. During its opening weekend, the movie grossed over $20 million, proving once again that teen horror flicks are a lucrative genre. Penelope Pulu has more.
In the movie adaptation of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark by producer Guillermo del Toro, monsters are coming alive out of the pages of a haunted storybook and claim the lives of teenagers. The Oscar-winning producer and filmmaker has likened these tales to campfire stories.
We've got to stop it.
There are two types of horror movies, ones that are disturbing and they sort of scar your soul permanently, and then there is a different type of horror movie which is like a roller coaster ride. It's fun and it's entertaining and is, really thrilling.
Filmmaker André Overdahl adapted the film from Alvin Schwartz's anthology of children's horror stories.
It's kind of a mix between a modern horror movie and a throwback to the Amblin movies I grew up with.
André Overdahl refers to the 80s Spielberg's influence of films such as Poltergeist, Goonies, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, where horror mixes with adolescent thrills and chills. But the story also borrows elements from 70s horror movies based on favorite Stephen King novels where supernatural forces are beckoned by the underdog, usually kids and teenagers, to exercise revenge, retribution on bullies, mean girls, and sinister corporations. Usually, the underdog displays superpowers or opens the gate to unseen, otherworldly forces, as in the case of Stella, a smart, timid girl from a nondescript Midwestern town.
Sarah Bellows, tell me a story.
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is not the only retro horror to scare its way to success.
At least someone's happy I'm home.
According to the streaming network Netflix, Stranger Things, a scary series with a teen cast, roared into its third season with 40 million viewers binge-watching the show within the first 4 days since its debut. This is not just a domestic trend. International series are now copying the formula, as in the case of the Indian teen horror, Typewriter, with teens once again finding their way in a haunted house, solving mysteries and facing ghosts. As for why do we crave horror movies?
Dread and suspense is this kind of wonderful thing that only exists in horror movies.
Sarah Bellows' book.
when the stories write themselves and it all comes alive.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the Migraine Research Foundation, migraines are an extraordinarily prevalent neurological disease affecting 1 billion people worldwide. To many who suffer from migraines, they are more than just a bad headache. A migraine attack can last anywhere from 4 to 72 hours, and for many can be accompanied by other symptoms such as vision difficulty, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, and sensitivity to sound, light, touch, and smell. Factors like the weather, sleep disturbances, hormonal changes, stress, certain medications, and foods or beverages have been known to trigger a migraine attack. Researchers at three Boston medical institutions have released a new study that suggests a link between drinking three or more caffeinated beverages a day with a migraine attack. They also found drinking one or two caffeinated beverages a day did not set off a migraine. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Woodstock fans are getting back to the garden to mark the 50th anniversary of the generation-defying festival. Bethel Woods Center for the Arts is hosting a series of events Thursday through Sunday at the bucolic 1969 concert site, and 130 kilometers northwest of New York City. Veteran Woodstocker Arlo Guthrie, is set to perform Thursday night tonight before an outdoor screening of the concert documentary on the famous field. And there won't be overcrowding or chaos this time. Visitors need to have event tickets and travel passes to drive to the site through the weekend. An estimated 400,000 people showed up for the original Woodstock Festival on upstate New York farmland in August of 1969. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to the identification or location of Salman Rauf Salman, also known as Samuel Salman Al-Rayda. He is a key leader of the terrorist organization Hezbollah. Salman is most well known for his prominent role in the July 18, 1994, bombing of the Argentine Jewish Mutual Aid Society, a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, which resulted in the deaths of 85 innocent civilians. Salman is a leader of Hezbollah's external security organization, which is responsible for planning, coordinating, and executing Hezbollah terrorist attacks around the globe. At the recently concluded Western Hemisphere Counterterrorism Ministerial, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Salman poses an ongoing threat.
He continues today to conduct terrorism on behalf of Hezbollah. The United States Department of Treasury has designated Salman as a specially designated global terrorist, and we believe this action will deny him all access to the U.S. financial system. We want this killer brought to justice.
The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Diplomatic Security Service. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If anyone has information about Salman Rauf Salman, please contact the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email lh@rewardsforjustice.net or the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA News.